Welcome to a deep dive, into the final chapters of Two Kings.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to be exploring the fall of Jerusalem and the
Bruh.
destruction of Solomon's temple.
It's a big one.
Yeah, it is.
It's a pivotal moment in biblical history.
It is.
And we're going to unpack not just what happened,
Right.
but why it happened
What do
and
you
what it means for understanding God's relationship with his people.
So we've got some really fascinating sources for you today,
Yeah.
including Dr. Oswald's insights.
He's great.
Yeah, you'll hear about Nebuchadnezzar's siege
Oh, yeah.
and the Babylonians just stripping the temple bare,
Just taking it all.
taking it all.
Yeah.
We're talking those huge bronze pillars, the massive bronze sea, even the pots and pans used in rituals.
Oh, wow.
Like the text goes into such detail.
It's almost like they're making a point, wouldn't you
Yeah.
say?
Yeah.
It's not just a dry inventory. It's
Yeah.
pointing to something much deeper, you know?
Okay.
The connection between the physical temple and what it represents.
So are you saying that there's like a deeper meaning behind all those details? I've
Exactly.
always wondered why the writer would include all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. And as we go through this, think about how those physical objects
Okay.
might relate to your own life.
Okay.
Are there things you hold sacred? Things that represent something deeper?
Yeah.
What happens when those things are threatened or taken away?
Okay, I'm starting to see where you're going with this.
Good.
So let's start with the fall of Jerusalem.
Okay.
The Babylonians didn't just conquer the city,
No, they
they
didn't.
systematically dismantled it.
It was brutal.
Yeah.
They had a three-step plan for rebellious cities.
Oh, really?
First, offer an alliance, but with a hefty tribute.
Okay.
Basically, play nice or pay up.
Right.
If the city rebelled back, they
Oh,
came with a siege.
wow.
And if they rebelled again,
Uh-oh.
total disruption.
Sounds like they weren't messing around.
Nope.
But wouldn't other cities see this and immediately fall in line?
You'd think so, right?
Yeah.
But remember, this is ancient history.
Right.
Pride and the desire for independence were powerful motivators.
Yeah.
And in Jerusalem's case, there was also this deep sense of being God's chosen people,
Right.
living in a city protected by God.
So they thought they were invincible.
In a way, yes. But that brings us back to the heart of the covenant.
Okay.
Remember, God's promise of protection
Yeah.
was conditional on the Israelites' faithfulness.
Right.
And unfortunately, they had strayed pretty far from that path.
This is where that Deuteronomic cycle comes in, right?
Yes.
Blessings for obedience, curses for disobedience. It's like that saying, what goes around comes around.
Exactly. But it's not just about karma
Okay.
or some cosmic scoreboard.
Right.
The Deuteronomic cycle highlights the natural consequences of our choices. Think about it.
Okay.
Haven't you seen that play out in your own life?
Oh, yeah.
When you make good choices, things tend to go well.
Right.
But when you mess up, well, there are consequences, right?
Definitely. It's like that cause and effect thing.
Yeah.
So Jerusalem was on its third strike,
Third strike, you're out.
and the Babylonians weren't messing around.
No.
And this destruction wasn't just about toppling buildings, it was
Right.
personal.
It was.
They went out of their way to desecrate the temple,
They did.
breaking apart those beautiful bronze pillars, the stands that massive bronze sea Solomon had created.
Right. And that's where it gets really fascinating.
Okay.
Remember those detailed descriptions of the temple treasures from 1 Kings 7? The writer didn't just randomly throw in those facts about the bronze pillars, the decorations, how
Yeah.
many cubits high each piece was.
Right.
It emphasized how grand and sacred the space was,
Right.
the place God chose to dwell among his people.
It's like they're saying, look at what's been lost. This is how important this place was, and now it's gone.
Yes.
Wow.
And by meticulously listing everything the Babylonians took, the writer is driving home the magnitude of the loss, both physically and spiritually.
No.
But it also raises a crucial question, Dr. Oswald asks.
Oh.
Can we construct a theology of the temple from this?
What do you think?
Can we?
I believe we can.
Okay.
But to do that, we need to understand the deeper symbolism at play.
So it's not just about bricks and mortar.
No.
It's about something bigger, something more symbolic.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And that symbolism
Okay.
is rooted in God's promise to Solomon in 1 Kings 9. Do you remember what God said about the temple?
He promised that it would stand as long as the Israelites remained faithful to the covenant.
Right.
Yeah.
So the destruction of the temple wasn't just about a military defeat.
Right.
It was a consequence of a broken relationship with God. It was a symbolic representation of their spiritual state.
Wow.
Dr. Oswald puts it beautifully when he says, "This is all symbolism. How beautiful are our hearts to him?
That beautiful. And what is the tragedy when our hearts are no longer his? They're a horror. They're ugly. They're a disaster.
Wow. That's a powerful image.
It is.
So you're saying that the physical temple represents something much bigger. The relationship between God and his people.
That's it.
And when that relationship is broken, the symbol is destroyed as well.
It is a sobering thought, isn't it?
It is.
It makes you think about the state of our own temples.
You mean our hearts?
Yes, our hearts. Oh. Because in the New Testament,
okay,
that's where God's presence resides. Not in building, but in us.
So even though the physical temple is gone,
right,
the concept of God dwelling among his people continues.
It does.
It just takes on a new, more personal form.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
Thank you.
And it leads us to an intriguing question.
Okay.
If we are the temple now, what does that mean for how we live our lives?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
It makes you think about how our actions, our words, even our thoughts might reflect God's presence.
Absolutely. And that's something we'll explore in more depth in the next part of our deep dive.
I can't wait.
But before we move on,
okay,
let's talk about that strange ending in 2 Kings.
Okay.
You know, where Jehoiachin, the exile king, is unexpectedly released from prison after 37 years?
Oh, yeah. That was crazy.
Yeah. It's a detail that often gets overlooked.
Uh-huh.
But it's incredibly significant.
Right.
Especially after all the destruction and despair we've just witnessed.
Right. It's like a glimmer of hope breaking through the darkness.
It is.
Why do you think the writer included that detail?
Well, imagine yourself in that situation.
Oh.
You've experienced incredible loss, maybe even exile from something you held dear.
Yeah.
You've seen everything crumble around you.
Right.
And then out of the blue, a glimmer of hope appears.
Wow.
Do you think that might change your perspective?
It would definitely give you something to hold on to, some reason to believe that things might get better.
Exactly. And that's what Dr. Oswalt suggests is happening here.
Okay.
He says, the book is finished. But is the story over? No, no. It's a reminder that even in the darkest moments, even when things seem hopeless, God is still working.
So even though the temple is gone, God is still present.
He is?
He's still working out his plan, even if we don't understand it.
And sometimes those plans unfold in unexpected ways.
Right.
Just when you think the story is over, he surprises you with a new beginning.
Wow, I like that.
But just like those cities tempted to rebel against Babylon,
we
often get caught up in our own plans and desires, forgetting about the covenant and what it means to be God's people.
And those details of the covenant are crucial, right?
They are.
It's not just some abstract theological concept.
No, it's not.
It has real world implications for how we live our lives.
It does.
So let's dive into the Deuteronomic history.
Okay.
And what it tells us about the essence of the covenant.
Now that's where things get really interesting. Remember, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings are all written through the lens of Deuteronomy.
Right.
It's like looking at history through a specific filter.
Right.
A filter that highlights the importance of the covenant.
Right. It's all about that Deuteronomic cycle, blessings for faithfulness, curses for disobedience.
That's it.
And in Kings, we see that play out through the reigns of the different kings.
Exactly.
It's not just about who had the most power or wealth.
It's about who was devoted to God.
Okay.
And followed the covenant.
Right.
That the yardstick by which they were measured.
Wow.
And that's a great transition to the next part of our deep dive.
I can't wait to unpack those key elements of the covenant.
We'll get into that.
It feels like we're just scratching the surface here.
Oh, yeah, there's so much more.
Stay tuned, because in the next part, we'll explore what it means to be faithful to the covenant.
Right.
And how those ancient principles apply to our lives today.
So we've seen the consequences, you know, of breaking the covenant. The fall of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, the exile of God's people.
Right.
But what does it look like to live, you know, within that covenant?
Yeah, that's a big question.
It is.
It's almost like starting over, redefining your relationship with God when the familiar landmarks are gone.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder what those ancient principles even look like in our modern world.
It's a process, for sure. And it starts by understanding that the essence of the covenant isn't about a place or a building.
Right.
It's about aligning your heart with God's heart, letting his values shape how you live, regardless of your circumstances.
So how do we translate those ancient principles into something relevant today?
Yeah.
What does absolute devotion to Yahweh look like when we're bombarded with distractions and conflicting priorities?
Right.
It feels a bit overwhelming, honestly.
I hear you. It's easy to feel lost in the chaos.
Yeah.
But maybe that's the point.
Okay.
Absolute devotion doesn't mean doing everything perfectly. It means making a conscious choice to put God first, even when it's inconvenient or messy.
Right.
It's about recognizing his presence in your life, not just on Sundays, but in every moment.
So it's about those daily choices, those little acts of faith that add up over time.
Yeah.
What are some practical ways we can do that? I mean, how do you actually do that when your to-do list is a mile long?
It can be surprisingly simple.
Okay.
It might be as straightforward as setting aside a few minutes each day to pray and reflect. Or maybe it's about studying scripture and really letting those words sink in. Mm-hmm. It could even be about being mindful of your thoughts and words, trying to align them with God's values. And don't underestimate the power of serving others.
Yeah.
That's a powerful way to experience God's love in action.
It's like weaving your faith into the fabric of your life rather than trying to keep it separate.
Exactly.
That makes a lot more sense than feeling like you have to be perfect all the time.
It is a journey, not a destination.
Right.
And speaking of things that trip us up,
okay,
let's talk about idolatry.
Okay.
That's one of those ancient concepts that feels like it's evolved over time.
Yeah.
It's not just about bowing down to statues anymore, is it?
Yeah, it feels much more subtle now.
Yeah.
Like, what are the modern day idols we're tempted to worship?
That's the key question, isn't it? Because in essence, idolatry is anything we put before God in our hearts. Anything that becomes more important than our relationship with him.
So it's about those things we rely on for security or fulfillment.
Yeah.
Those things we turn to instead of seeking it in God.
Think about your own life. Is it your career that consumes you, driving every decision? Is it the pursuit of possessions, always wanting more, bigger, better? Maybe it's social status. The need to be seen and admired. It could even be your own desires and ambitions. Those things you chase relentlessly, even at the expense of your well-being. Those can all become idols if we let them.
It's a good reminder to check our priorities.
Uh-huh.
To make sure we're not giving our hearts to something that can't truly satisfy.
Right.
But what about that idea of trusting in Yahweh alone?
Yeah.
In a world that often feels chaotic and unpredictable.
Right.
It's easy to get caught up in fear and anxiety.
It is.
How do you maintain that trust when things get tough?
You're absolutely right. It's a daily practice, a conscious choice to surrender your worries and fears to God.
Okay.
It's about remembering that he is in control even when you can't see the path ahead.
Right.
Think back to times when you've experienced God's faithfulness.
Okay.
Those moments when he's come through for you, those memories can be anchors in the storm, reminding you that he's still with you, even in the midst of chaos.
So it's about shifting your perspective, trusting in God's bigger picture, even when you can't see the details.
And it's about surrendering your need for control.
Yeah.
And that can be a tough one, but it's incredibly freeing when you can let go and trust that God's got this.
But it's not just about our personal relationship with God, right?
Right.
The covenant also has this outward focus.
Yeah.
This emphasis on treating others with kindness and generosity, especially those who are vulnerable. In a world that often feels so divided and polarized.
It does.
How do we live this out in a way that actually makes a difference?
Right.
It can feel so overwhelming, like one person can't really change anything.
You're right. The world can feel like a pretty broken place sometimes.
Yeah.
But that's exactly where the covenant comes in.
Okay.
It reminds us that we're not meant to live in isolation.
Right.
Focused only on ourselves.
Yeah.
It's about recognizing the inherent dignity and worth of every human being, regardless of their background, beliefs, or circumstances.
So how do we translate that into action? What does it look like to live that out in our daily lives?
It starts with seeing others through the eyes of compassion.
Okay.
It's about putting yourself in their shoes and trying to understand their perspective,
right,
even if you don't agree with them. It's about seeking ways to meet their needs, both physical and emotional.
Okay.
Whether it's offering a helping hand, a listening ear, or a word of encouragement.
That's not just about avoiding harm. It's about actively seeking the well-being of others.
Exactly. It's about going beyond your comfort zone,
right,
extending grace and mercy, even to those who may not deserve it.
Wow.
It's about being a bridge builder, an agent of reconciliation and healing in a fractured world.
It sounds like a tall order.
It can be.
But it also feels hopeful, like maybe we can make a difference even in small ways.
And that's the beauty of the covenant.
Yeah.
It's not about achieving some unattainable standard of perfection.
Right.
It's about aligning our hearts with God's heart, allowing His love and grace to flow through us and into the world.
So even though the physical temple is gone, the spirit of the covenant continues to guide us.
Yes. And that spirit invites us to be living temples,
okay,
reflecting God's presence and love in the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
But that raises a fascinating question.
Okay.
If we are the temple now,
mm-hmm,
what does it mean for God to dwell in us?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I guess it makes you wonder how our presence in the world, our very being, reflects God's character and purposes.
That's a deep dive for another day.
Yeah.
But for now, let's keep that question in mind as we move into the final part of our discussion.
Okay.
We'll explore what it means to be agents of God's redeeming work in the world.
Okay.
How those seemingly small acts of faithfulness,
right,
can ripple outwards and create lasting change.
So we've journeyed through the fall of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, and explore the deeper meaning of the covenant.
Right. A lot to unpack there.
Yeah, it is. But the question that keeps coming back to me is this. How do we as individuals actually become agents of God's redeeming work in the world today?
It's the question that lingers, isn't it?
It does.
It can feel daunting, especially when we look around and see so much brokenness, so much pain.
Right.
Where do we even begin?
Exactly. It feels almost impossible to make a difference, you know, in the face of all that.
You know, I used to think that way too.
Yeah.
But I've come to realize that maybe we're asking the wrong question.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of focusing on what we can do to fix the world, maybe we should be asking, what is God already doing and how can I join Him in that work?
So it's less about imposing our own solutions and more about aligning ourselves with God's purposes.
That's it. Think of it like this.
Oh.
God is the master artist.
Okay.
And we're invited to be a part of His masterpiece.
Wow.
But we don't get to dictate the design.
Right.
We get to contribute our unique brushstrokes, our individual talents and passions to the larger canvas He's already creating.
That's a beautiful analogy.
Thank you.
But how do we discern God's movement? It's not like He sends us a roadmap or a to-do list.
He doesn't, at least not in the way we might expect.
Right.
But think back to our discussion about the covenant.
Okay.
God gives us a compass.
Okay.
His word, His spirit, the promptings of our hearts.
So you're saying we already have the tools we need to figure this out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's through prayer, through studying scripture, through listening to those quiet whispers of the spirit,
yeah,
we start to understand His will for our lives.
Right.
And it's not just about grand revelations or mystical experiences.
Around.
Sometimes it's in the ordinary, everyday moments,
okay,
that we find those extraordinary opportunities to be agents of redemption.
Can you give us some examples?
Yeah.
I think it would help to have a more concrete picture of what that might look like, you know, in our daily lives.
Well, imagine this. You're walking down the street and you see someone struggling.
Right.
Maybe they're homeless or just having a really bad day.
Yeah.
That's an opportunity.
Okay.
It might be as simple as offering a kind word, a smile, a moment of genuine connection.
Right.
Or maybe it's about seeing someone being mistreated and choosing to speak up to be an advocate for justice.
Wow.
And sometimes the most powerful acts of redemption happen within our own families and circles of friends.
Okay.
It could be extending forgiveness to someone who's hurt you, offering grace instead of judgment.
So it's not always about grand gestures or heroic feats.
No.
It's about those small, consistent acts of love and compassion that create a ripple effect, making the world a little bit brighter, a little bit kinder.
And think back to the idea of us being living temples.
Okay.
If God's presence dwells in us, then our actions should reflect His character, His love.
That makes me think about the fruit of the Spirit we read about in Galatians. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control.
All of those.
Like those qualities are the evidence of God's work in our lives. And when we embody those qualities, we're revealing His presence to the world.
That's such a powerful insight.
Thank you.
Every time we choose kindness over judgment, every time we offer grace instead of condemnation, every time we stand up for what's right, even when it's hard, we're not just doing good deeds. We're revealing the heart of God.
So being an agent of God's redeeming work is not just about what we do. It's about who we are becoming.
That's it. It's about aligning ourselves with God's heart, allowing his love to transform us from the inside out. And as we're transformed, we become agents of transformation in the world around us. It's not always easy.
Right? And there will be setbacks, but it's a journey worth taking.
And it's encouraging to remember that we're not in this alone.
Right.
God is working through us, empowering us to be instruments of his peace and healing. He doesn't expect us to have it all figured out.
No, he doesn't.
He just wants our willing hearts, hearts that are open to his leading.
And sometimes that leading comes in the most unexpected ways. Mm. Remember Jehoiachin?
Oh, yeah.
That exiled king who was suddenly released from prison after 37 years?
Oh, yeah. That was a twist. It seemed so random at the time, but now I'm starting to see how it fits into the bigger picture.
God is always at work, even when we can't see it. His plans unfold in ways we often don't expect. Just when we think the story is over, he surprises us with a new beginning.
So even in the midst of exile, even when things seem hopeless,
yeah,
there's still room for hope and redemption.
Absolutely. And that hope is rooted in God's unwavering love and faithfulness. He never abandons his people, even when they stray from his path.
Right.
He's always there waiting to welcome us back and restore us to wholeness. So this deep dive into the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple is actually not a story of despair, but a story of hope.
It's a story of transformation, of God's presence moving from a physical structure to the hearts of his people. It's a reminder that sometimes what looks like the end is actually a new beginning.
And it's a challenge for us to consider how we can be living temples reflecting God's love and grace in a world that desperately needs it.
So as you go from this deep dive, consider this. What does it look like for you to embody the principles of the covenant in your daily life? How can you be an agent of God's redeeming work in the world?
It's a question worth pondering, a challenge worth embracing. Mm-hmm. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. May we all go forth with renewed hope and a deeper commitment to being living temples of God's presence in the world.